This episode of Midori House was first broadcast on the 29th of October, 2015, on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, peace talks on Syria begin in Vienna with one apparently obvious absence from the table, Syrians. Is this an admission that the country barely still exists? And will the talks accomplish anything? My guests Mary Dajewski and Robert Fox will be here to discuss that and the day's other top stories, including the chances of Sir John Chilcot actually delivering his inquiry into the Iraq war before the sun dies, China's seizure of crazed liberal zeal in scrapping its one-child policy for a two-child policy, and over the audible spinning noises from the graves of Lincoln and Eisenhower, we'll score the 2016 Republican field after last night's debate. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller, right now. And welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Mary Dajewski and Robert Fox. Mary Dajewski of The Independent, Robert Fox of The Evening Standard. Welcome both back to the programme. We are going to start tonight with those Syria peace talks due to begin in Vienna tomorrow. So much of the build-up has been dominated by one surprising addition to the guest list, Iran, that one obvious omission has been rather overlooked. For a discussion aimed at ending a war in Syria, it appears to involve remarkably few Syrians. The main political opposition group, the Syrian National Coalition, have not been invited, nor have representatives even of the less obviously deranged armed opposition. Mary Dajewski, the SNC, for what they may still be worth, says that their omission suggests a lack of seriousness. Are they right?
Well, I actually think they're probably wrong, because they haven't actually done nearly as much as they could do to present themselves as a plausible force with decent representatives who could turn up at a table and actually present something that was deliverable. So I think there's a reason maybe why they're not there. But I think there's a bigger reason why Syrians in general aren't there, because my understanding is that this meeting is actually less about Syria per se than it is about trying to get an international consensus that will underpin whatever and put pressure on whatever the Syrians themselves can be persuaded to do. So I think it's about establishing some sort of framework before they try to put the Syrians into it. And I don't think that's necessarily a stupid thing to do, because if you can get pretty much all the neighbours and all the powers in the region together, and in the unlikely event you can actually agree something, then I think that's almost a precondition for any deal in Syria being able to hold.
Robert, that all sounds fairly sensible and relatively plausible, but the obvious flaw in the plan is you're trying to build consensus among players, including but not limited to the United States, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Russia and Turkey, not all of whom are known for getting on fantastically well with each other.
I think this is a meeting about meeting. I'm absolutely in agreement with, as I always have, I hope, with Mary about this, but absolutely correct. There is no plausible opposition to take over from Assad at the moment, and it seems that there's nobody indigenously Syrian, if I can put it like that, that could rule the whole country in its present state. I think it's very interesting you named those allies, of whom one of the most sensitive and important must be Turkey. And they won't talk Turkey, horrible pun, but they won't get down to the real business until they've cleared the Turkish election out of the way. That may not be as easy as it sounds. The play out may take 2 or 3 weeks or months. The other thing that is becoming clear, because Russia has changed facts on the ground, is that the Secretary of State, Mr. Kerry, cannot just read out a menu and say, I want you to do this, this, and this. Of course, the figure who is in play is Assad himself. And the Russians are saying, we've got to stick behind our man, and so on. That's not true. Actually, if you listen very carefully, if you read very carefully what Moscow, and particularly Sergei Lavrov, has been saying, we need to get to a position, and we believe anyway Assad should be there for the time being, but they have pushed him, whatever you may think about it, to elections next year. And Russia has stated that it is for a settlement. They do want a settlement. Two things, if I'm be very quick about it. One thing, I don't think things have stabilised on the ground enough. There's still a lot of fighting to go, unfortunately. When you've got people on the ground who still think that they can fight it out, I think that is troubling. The other troubling element from which we can expect a lot of niggling, possibly even worse, is Saudi Arabia and Iran.
On that note, Mary, because that is the obvious subtext to it, or the obvious new wild card being played here, the invitation of Iran to sit down with a lot of countries with whom they don't get on. There's already been a bit of pre-conference trash talk by Iran about Saudi Arabia, who have called the Saudis dubious and illegitimate, which is all good fun, and I'm sure Riyadh speaks highly of them as well. Is it really that likely that they will cooperate with each other over this? Do Iran and Saudi Arabia actually have a common interest in Syria?
Well, I think they have one common interest, which pretty much everybody else has as well, which is that things are only getting worse there. So unless either Saudi and Iran think that they solo can actually bring order and bring security to themselves, then in a way they're pushed towards at least talking to each other, because I think security for almost everybody is a prime concern.
And just a final thought on this before we look at the detritus of the last big war in the Middle East, Robert. To what extent is the rivalry between Iran and Saudi Arabia, which is being manifested in different spots all over the Middle East, is it just about basic power, or should we not underestimate the influence of religion?
Oh, I think you do have to factor in confessionalism. And I think, by the way, the Occidental, the Western commentary doesn't take it into account enough. I mean, with Iraq, you have got Arab Shias who still look to the Grand Ayatollah Sistani. They are clear that although they welcome support from Iran, Persians and Azeris, that is a big division. But one thing I'd like to add, Andrew, to what Mary was saying, do not think of Saudi Arabia and Iran as monoliths. There are big divisions in both very large, very powerful countries appearing over Syria and the Iran nuclear deal. Yep. The Revolutionary Guard is very split off from the Zarif foreign minister Rouhani diplomatic line because they see themselves as losing power and credibility. Equally, where you can call now this very militant new administration, if we could put it like that, in Saudi Arabia with King Salman, where he can be called still is the sheer amount of influence, money and recruits going to Daesh, ISIS, Islamic State, from the Gulf Arab communities.
I'd just like to add to that that I think that the position of Iran may be slightly misunderstood. I think there are splits, as you say, but I was at a gathering last week where there was a senior Iranian official, and one of the things he was very concerned to point out was that Iran wasn't always and forever a champion of Shia just because they were Shia. He pointed out that, and it may be part of Iran being sort of readmitted to the international process all over again. He wanted to show that they were somehow bigger than this. They weren't sectarians. They were interested in something greater.
Okay, well, next tonight, it ill behooves journalists, perhaps, of all people, to condemn others for taking a detached view of deadlines. But it is fair to say that were the eminent British Mandarin Sir John Chilcot a mere hack, his section editor would have long since bundled him down the stairs. Sir John's report into the 2003 Iraq War has already been longer in the making than World War II, and according to an announcement today, will now not be published until next summer. Mary, first of all, Chilcot is claiming, by way of mitigation, that it will be 2 million words long. I have looked this up. Gibbon knocked over the entire decline and fall of Rome in three quarters of that. How much is there to actually say at this point?
Well, I mean, I'm very critical of the 2 million words. And whenever I see anybody who's actually on the commission, my first question is obviously, when is your report going to appear? And my second one is when they say, oh, well, it's so long, it's 2 million words, is to say, for heaven's sake, what sort of an editor have you got? Because 2 million words is not a report. 2 million words is, well, I don't know what it is, but it's not going to elucidate anything. So I think between now and then, which is obviously an absolutely vain hope, somebody needs to get together with the cutting scissors and the summary skills and produce something that people are going to understand.
I mean, is there, and this is a certain amount of paranoia in this possibly, the whole 2 million words, the bulk of the thing, Robert, is this a desire to try and bury anything difficult at about page 3,682 in the hope that everybody gives up before they get to it?
I think there is a certain amount of that to the extent that it's one damn thing after another. What I get, and particularly, as you said, from his remarks today, what I get from Sir John Chilcot, I'm sorry to say, you say eminent Mandarin, yes, well, possibly, but he's a thoroughly confused person still. He was confused about the way he should conduct it. I fear he has left the suspicion that he has been intimidated by the caste from which he came, the British Civil Service, and he didn't cut to the chase exactly as Mary says. If you're creating policy, if you're creating a strategy, if you're creating a battle plan, if you're trying to get the newspaper out this evening for it to become tomorrow's fish and chips, you know damn well you work to a deadline and you make sure it's going to be read. I've talked to Margaret Aldred, for 'tis she who is writing this thing, and she says it's ruined her life and so on and so forth. But why did not anybody say, stop, let's think of it? And somebody who did write a thing almost of this length, namely the official biography of Winston Churchill, alas, Sir Martin Gilbert, has died, who was on the panel. And he would have taken something to the writing. But more than the writing, the thing that worries me was the way the evidence was examined. It is absolutely clear. Several very senior and eminent and rather disinterested, I must say, British politicians said there should have been a judge, there should have been proper advocacy, and there should have been cross-examination. When people like Tony Blair and Gordon Brown, former prime ministers, went there, they grandstanded. They grandstood. Is that really the participle? But you really see what I mean.
I think we go with that.
But they didn't come back with the evidence. Now, for hacks, serious hacks like the three round this table, actually it's going to be a goldmine because we'll be able to go into it forensically and see various things. I am pretty damn sure, pound to penny, in major testimony, you will find a contradiction as to what was said in the verbal transcripts and as to what comes out after it is bowdlerized, they say, because of legal niceties and so on. I think it's a valuable exercise. I think it has been conducted disastrously. But the thing that I also fear is that it will be used as a Latin hindrance, not to do anything like it before. For goodness sake, UK is crying out for something done in time and right speedily. The disaster, which was almost equal, of the British involvement in Afghanistan over roughly the same period, and also this present administration or the present prime minister doesn't get entirely off the hook because his manoeuvrings over Libya and Syria, it must say, is... You should have the kind of grand jury examination that you get in a congressional hearing in the United States.
Mary, the thing that strikes me about the Chilcot thing is that the Iraq War was pretty much the first war conducted in the full glare of modern online media, in which the politics and the diplomacy and the legalities were unpicked almost as they went along. Endless numbers of books have already been written about it. Everything has been gone over, disinterred, fossick through. What do you still wish you knew that you don't already know, that you hope that somewhere in Chilcot's volumes there will be the answer?
Well, there's been a lot of criticism right down the years of the lack of experts and the lack of people who knew anything about Iraq being involved in the proceedings at any stage before or during the war. And what I'd like to know is how Bremer made the decision to dissolve the whole of the Ba'athist power structures, which directly led to the breakdown of law and order and chaos in Iraq. And I want to know on whose advice, if any, that decision was taken.
That is an extraordinary moment. It is plausibly the single worst decision of the 21st century, that particular one to abolish the Iraqi military and the Ba'ath Party.
I think it's a yolk in the egg, if I can put it like that. And what goes round it is why And there's enough of history to show you this, namely the insurrection in Mesopotamia in the year that Iraq became Iraq in 1920 by Elmer Haldane, where they faced an outright national insurrection against what was seen as Anglo-led occupation. Why did they not see that they would be seen as occupiers? And I was in Basra in the June, July when military policemen were being killed and so on. You could feel the mood changing. And just, sorry to do a bit of a perpendicular pronoun, I wrote a little piece in The Standard saying, this isn't, we are not welcome liberators, our boys, nor the Allies. And I got a call from a very senior general's wife. Immediately I got back, thank you for rocking the boat in the Evening Standard, Robert. There was, sorry, Andrew, you cannot believe that it was the atmosphere of delusion, of self-deception in Whitehall and in Washington that was going on. But the bit that I want to know is how Tony Blair twisted the legal opinion to say it was actually okay. It was within the parameters of international law at the time, which, as we know from Elizabeth Wilmshurst, the duty legal officer in the Foreign Office at the time, it most certainly wasn't.
Final thought on this one, Mary. What did you make of Blair's recent semi/non-apology? I think the derisive chortle from Robert there will do for his answer. What did you make of it?
Well, I have to say I was probably as cynical as Robert was, because it did seem to me to be the latest of a series of sort of preemptive getting your answer in before the accusation has been made from Tony Blair. The timing did seem to be extraordinary. There didn't seem to be any good reason other than the supposed imminence of the Chilcot inquiry as to why Blair would come out then. I mean, he's had so long to think about this. This has gone through right the mill of the Labour Party, the successive British governments. There is no reason why now, other than that there are going to be accusations made, further accusations in public, and he risks looking worse than he has done before. I'd also like to add a little footnote that I think that the long-term, the shadow of Iraq, the way it's going to affect British politics and has already afflicted British politics, is going to last for a long time longer. And that, you know, what's seen as the extraordinary election of Jeremy Corbyn as head of the Labour Party in Britain can be directly seen as an indirect result of the Iraq war.
Absolutely agree with that. Every word of that.
We're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, along with Mary Dejewski and Robert Fox. Coming up next, the Chinese Communist Party abandons one of its signature policies. But why? And why now?
Join Monocle 24's international editors and correspondents as they touch down in a different city each week. Come on board for a one-stop audio guide to the most dynamic emerging cities around the world. This week we're in Sarajevo. As well as hospitality highlights and key cultural hotspots, we'll also visit new retail spaces, sample the local food scene, and meet the design denizens that a potentially time-poor traveller can ill afford to miss. The Voyager, in association with Turkish Airlines, is now boarding.
If you're after a soundtrack to your working day, look no further than Monocle 24's Globally Minded playlist. We play the very best upbeat music from around the world, around the clock. Whether that's jazz from Japan, pop from Paris, house from Hamburg, or soul from Seoul. It's all picked by our team and presented by our editors. So get lost in music with Monocle 24's playlist, right here, day and night, on Monocle 24.
And you're welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. Still with me are Mary Dejewski and Robert Fox. Now, for 36 years, it's been the most internationally infamous example of the Chinese Communist Party's desire to micromanage the lives of its billion-plus subjects. The one-child policy, which limited most urban couples to a single child and most rural couples to two if their first was a girl. The Communist Party believes that 400 million births at least have been discouraged, but at a considerable cost in unintended demographic consequences. As a result, it has been announced that Chinese couples will henceforth be permitted two children without penalty. Robert, first of all, how big a deal is this? Is this a huge climb down from the Chinese Communist Party, or are they just adjusting to the times?
Bit of both. They've signalled it. for quite some time, because economically, in terms of the economy, your engine is running down because of the one-child policy. You have the famous or infamous maximum: will China grow grey before it grows rich? Because what you're going to have, it's actually quite similar to Europe. You're facing an increasing aging population, where there is a disproportionate imbalance between productive and non-productive. And you're not going to fix it with this, by the way. It takes a long time.
Not quickly, anyway.
It is generational. It's interesting. In the commentary, people don't look at things like natality, that is fertility, as well as mortality. And you have to look at morbidity, because there's also the worry when you move people around a lot, you're going to get disease or peculiar effects. But this is where China is in a very different position from, say, with all its problems, India, because India has got this burgeoning young population. It's oddly, it's not quite the same thing. But you know, the fact is that most of Europe is aging so dramatically. I think a lot of that has coloured Merkel's thinking about migrants. I don't think it computed very well. And Russia, particularly European Russia, Mary's great area of expertise, seems to be in dire difficulties. But managing populations, by the way, it's not a new thing. You know that even people like Churchill, they were eugenicists, they believed in this kind of thing. It's very, very difficult to do, because the natality rate actually has to be 2.2 per productive family. It's not the two-child thing. And when you're, as Germany is, I think now, down to the 1.56s, and quite a large part of Russia down to the 1.3, you're in really big trouble.
Mary, as always with China, the numbers are absolutely mind-boggling. That 400 million Chinese that never were amounts to, on its own, the third biggest country in the world, if it existed. One of their other concerns is anything up to and around 30 million young men already alive who will never be able to find wives. That's larger than the population of Australia. How big a concern is that particular unintended consequence of this to China? That, you know, there's been all sorts of studies that suggest that large numbers of otherwise, you know, unoccupied young men tends to favour the development of especially militarised societies, for obvious reasons.
Well, I think it's potentially catastrophic. I mean, it's like a gigantic, gigantic experiment. And the whole of the population of a certain of that particular generation is completely skewed. And it's largely because of the infanticide of girls, and the fact that if you didn't have a boy first time around, then you wanted a boy and you were only allowed to have one. So if you had a girl, then a lot of those girls didn't actually live. So that's one of the reasons, one of the chief reasons for the imbalance. But we've got to see. I mean, I've seen the most extraordinary sort of fantastic imaginary solutions to this in the last couple of days. There have been discussions of people saying that, oh well, you know, the men should that they'll have to share wives. Or that China should advertise itself as a sort of tourist spot for women from other places who are desperately in search of a husband. So, you know, there are these sort of things going on in the background. But I think the actual surfeit of men to women that there is in that particular age group, I mean, I don't think we've seen that anywhere in the world. And it's a lot of people.
It is an extraordinary thought. Robert, a final brief thought on this. Do we get any sense that also maybe it's a recognition by the Communist Party that maybe subsequent upcoming generations of Chinese people aren't quite as keen on having the state in their bedroom as their previous generations were?
Oh, I think that's, not that I know China at all well, I think that's always been in there. A great friend of mine, a wonderful writer for the Washington Post, Lassie, doesn't write about China anymore, but went to China at 19 and spoke really good Chinese and wrote a wonderful autobiography, I commend it, John Pomfret, Chinese Lessons. And you see this almost Italian, southern Italian, Sicilian attitude to the state amongst his colleagues that he studied with. He didn't go to a university for foreigners. He went to a proper Chinese university in Nanjing. And you do have this very, very odd relationship. And I think the hierarchy is well aware of it, that it's been seen, think of Prince Charles's remark, as a gerontocracy. And I think that that is worrying. I do agree there is a hormonal almost imbalance there, because I think this is also one of the really worrying things about the Middle East. There's a lot of unemployed, very, very angry post-adolescent or adolescent young Arab men primarily, who are very, very angry indeed. And that means trouble.
It certainly does. Well, finally tonight, the many Americans still seeking the Republican nomination for president went round again last night in the third GOP debate, this time in a basketball arena at the University of Colorado. As previously, four of the more obviously absurd contenders, Santorum, Pataki, Jindal and Graham, were the opening act, while the 10-person main event once again offered the sobering reminder that Donald Trump is still only maybe the third most ridiculous option. Mary, did we learn anything in particular last night?
Well, as I gather, we didn't really learn very much at all, except that CNBC is apparently not the best station to be running election debates. They seem to have come in for enormous criticism. It looks as though Marco Rubio, senator from Florida, that he actually came out on top. He sounded just about more sensible and more plausible than some of the others. Jeb Bush appears to have done very badly, which has angered him in a way, because he obviously thought that if he could somehow sideline Trump, then he was next in line. And he's probably not terribly pleased to be bested by somebody else from Florida. And it's interesting to me, as somebody who covered the 2000 election, that Florida is once again in the frame, because this is a place where it's balanced absolutely 50-50 Democrat Republican at every level, from the local legislature up through the national legislature, up through the Senate elections, that everything is absolutely on a knife edge in Florida. So if you get through that, you're, as it were, a tried and tested tempered politician.
Robert, should we be getting worried yet by the fact that the two obvious Yahoo contenders, by which I mean Trump and Carson, have not actually burned out yet?
Yes and no. I'm not as close as Mary. I have not regularly covered the US beat, but I looked at it. I did find the Rubio Jeb Bush relationship, and Jeb Bush made a terrible mistake. He made a terrible mistake by trying to patronize Rubio as his pupil. But Jeb Bush, very unusually for a Bush so early on, He hasn't got the charisma of W in front of a microphone, it must be said. He looks a loser. He really does. Trump, I think, is interesting because he looks as if he's the court jester all the time, particularly with the comb over, and he plays it. And he is probably... He's beginning to emerge, I fear, to me, to be the Republican right's Boris Johnson. They play the clown, and it's the political clown. What I think is going to be so interesting and so difficult for the GOP is I think Trump is going to run anyway. I think we've had signals of that. If he doesn't get the Republican ticket, that he will run as an independent. Then they say it will be a shoo-in for Hillary. The only thing with Hillary, because we are exactly the same age, she's only a shade younger than me, I wonder if she's just got enough gas in her tank for it.
I think the other interesting thing about the Republicans' debate was that for the first time, they pretty much know who they're going to be opposing. So there was some of that angling, deliberate angling of what they said, which was directed not at their rivals, but at Hillary.
And just, I guess, a final...
And she's been doing very well, though, lately.
She has indeed. But just a final thought from each of you then, and just quickly, pick the Republican nominee this far out, if you will. You won't be held to it, but at this point, who would your money be on? Robert?
I wouldn't rule out Rubio.
Okay. And Mary?
No, I'm going to be boring and agree, not least because I think there is a Bush family problem, which is actually the same problem that Clinton faces, that you're starting to have dynasties and American voters won't like that.
We will have to leave it there. Mary Dejeski and Robert Fox, thank you both very much as ever for joining us. That's all for today's edition of Midori House. It was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Our studio manager was Kieran Banerjee. As for the next half hour, Chris Lord is keeping you company with Monocle's international playlist. The Urbanist follows at 1900, The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. I'll be your host for that. But for this edition, it's goodbye, and thanks very much for listening.